Hello and welcome to Principles of App Compat. My name is Chris Jackson. I am frequently known as the App Compat guy, and here to talk to you about the fundamental principles that really help to drive a successful transition project from one platform to another, whether it's an operating system or a browser or an office suite or any other component of your environment. And when it comes to App Compat, it really all starts with your applications and understanding what it means to be compatible. So when we say that an application is compatible, here's what we mean. You're never going to get to the point where you have an application that's fully compliant, because at some level that really means it doesn't have any bugs, right? That's not really possible. A compatible application instead is an application that has no bugs on the platform that you want that stop you from getting your work done. And that's the important part right there. It's the part that there's no bugs that stop you from getting your work done that drive how you're going to go about validating whether or not your application is truly compatible. If you stay higher up and are just looking to find an application that has no bugs, you're going to find yourself bouncing against a mathematical proof done by this gentleman. His name is Alan Turing, who proved back in 1936 that it's actually not possible to prove that an application has no bugs whatsoever. So the focus becomes bugs that stop you from getting your work done. And the way to do that is to focus on, can I get my work done? Right? Really very effectively done by end users. And a lot of the other work that we end up doing ends up helping to accommodate the end user's time, since they're typically not a part of that project. When we also think about our applications, we also want to be mindful of the assets that they represent to the organization. When you're dealing in application compatibility, that's when you kind of tend to surface a lot of the stuff that's kind of old, that's been around for a long time. And I have run into applications that are in excess of 18, 19, 20 years old that are still in use today. And there's kind of a temptation to think, because it's old, that means it's not good. And the better way to think about it is not, software's like milk, it goes bad, because it's not, but rather to think that software is a work of engineering. And as a work of engineering, it's designed with a particular lifespan in mind. So here, for example, is some engineering work that was done for buildings back in the World's Fair for 1904. Now, these buildings were designed to last for the duration of the World's Fair. They're designed in a Greco-Roman architecture. They look a lot similar to what you might find in ancient Greece or ancient Rome, but they had very different requirements. The buildings in Greece, some of them have been standing for literally thousands of years. They are designed and engineered and use materials designed to make them last that long. The buildings for the World's Fair were designed to last for 1 year. So instead of building them out of, say, marble, they were built out of plaster of Paris and hemp. And they had to be serviced a lot more regularly. Now, there's nothing wrong with building buildings out of marble, and there's nothing wrong with building them out of plaster of Paris and hemp. It depends on what you intend to keep them around for, right? Do you want them to last for a year, or do you want them to last for 3,000 years? A big difference is the building that lasts 3,000 years costs a lot more money and is designed intentionally to survive for that long. The same is true for software. If you design your software to survive for 10, 15, 20 years, then it's reasonable to expect that it will. Most people don't design it and invest so much upfront to make it live that long, and that's where the problem comes in, is when you have software that was really designed to live for 2, 3, 4 years that you're trying to keep around for 20. Those are the harder problems. So don't think that old is bad. Think that old, when it's not designed to survive that long, represents an opportunity. So that's at the individual application level. I think another consideration to keep in mind is, what about at the entire inventory level of all of the applications that I have? One of the things that I find with the customers that I work with on application compatibility and migration projects is that they often don't even know what they've got. You know, we start the project with an inventory. Well, let's find out what software is running so I understand what my real risk is. Well, that tells me that they're not really super focused on software asset management. They don't have an adequate inventory, so therefore they can't be managing that inventory for business gain. So when we think about software asset management, I think there's a couple of things that come to mind first. And the centerpiece is really where most of the customers I work with start, license management. The reason being that there were a lot of companies, you know, around about 2008 when the economy started to become a little bit challenged, who weren't getting the same software revenues from new purchases, so therefore they were looking to their existing customers and to do true-ups of their licensing to go and find where they might owe them for software they're using but hadn't paid for the licenses on. So there's a direct benefit to being able to adequately and accurately measure the license use that was being done. So there's sort of a payoff for the investments you do in software asset management. But I think there's some additional dimensions worth exploring. The topic on the right, application portfolio management. As you start to get your handle on the things that are driving your business, you start to be able to better manage them going forward for business benefit, right? To start thinking about what should I be investing in? Are my software assets aligned with my business goals? And on the left-hand side, application quality certification, another real important consideration, which is, am I in a position today where software gets introduced into my organization based purely on the fact that someone was able to buy it, or based on the fact that someone was able to get it to compile and load it up, and have I put in any requirements that can start to measure the overall quality or the alignment with my technical goals? You know, as one example, I see a lot of customers today who are coming from a world of most of their web applications are built on what we would today call the legacy web, right? We find that on average 70% of enterprise web applications are built on what we call today IE5 Quirks modes, which is emulating a 1999 implementation of web standards. Now, while that certainly helps to make those software investments far more durable, there's a challenge with that in that it's going to become progressively harder to find people who can maintain that software. I'm also not going to be taking advantage of innovations that might help me to create a better user experience, that might help the software become more manageable, that might even potentially help me reduce the amount of bandwidth that I need to transmit that application to my users. A lot of those are a bit of what we think of as soft benefits, but the thing I always would say in response to that is that if you're unwilling to consider a positive user experience as being organizationally valuable, then you're essentially declaring that if you can't be vague, you know, precisely right, you'd rather be precisely wrong. There's a lot of no cost, you know, no hard value options that you can benefit from as a result of modernizing your application portfolio, and those things tend to materialize over time. And when I think about that from a portfolio perspective, I think about things like, am I better able to take on more risk? Because with being able to take on more risk comes the ability to reap more reward. Right? That becomes an option once I'm able to start driving down some of the cost of maintaining things as well as innovating on the latest platforms. I'm able to spend less of my time focusing on the application stack, not focusing on the server anymore, not focusing on the operating system or the runtime, but in the applications, which are the components that are actually delivering business value. I can get a view into how much of my IT investments are going into just keeping the lights on, the sustaining technologies, and try to turn that around where most of my investments are going into creating new capabilities. And all of that comes together to start to transform the pace at which my technology can keep up with the business so that we move away from having systems of record dominating our attention and instead are able to focus more time on creating systems of innovation and systems of differentiation, which really help the organization differentiate itself from its competition. So that software asset management, really helping to manage my software against my business objectives, built upon a platform. I think the other consideration from a platform perspective is, you know, sometimes you have some platforms that maybe are getting a bit long in the tooth, if you will. And I think it's important to keep in mind that any software platform is going to eventually become irrelevant. Again, not just because it's old, but because it's no longer able to deliver the requirements that you have for your software or your software platform. There's plenty of software platforms that have been out there for a really long time. As one really terrific example, we've been living with Visual Basic 6 for a very long time. It was introduced in 1998 as part of Visual Studio 98. Visual Basic 6 will continue to be supported at least through the lifespan of the Windows 8 series of products, which means we're going to be carried through until somewhere around 2022 at a minimum. That means by the time we're done, Visual Basic 6 will have had a lifespan of 24 years, outliving the musician Buddy Holly is one example, outliving Betamax or even the venerable Windows XP, which most people think has been around for a long time, outliving the warranty that I have on my car, whether I have, you know, a Hyundai or a BMW or any other car. Visual Basic 6 is going to have outlasted all of those as a work of engineering, and certainly outlasting a lot of the platforms that are iterating much more quickly, such as web browsers. So there are a lot of platforms that have had a really good lifespan, but with that extended lifespan becomes the potential for some risk. For example, one of the conversations I frequently have with customers is around their strategy for Java and maintaining a particular Java Virtual Machine version. And a lot of organizations look to have a standardized version that they want to be able to keep fairly stable for a long period of time. That ends up driving a lot of organizational risk. If you look at this chart here, this is actually pulled from the Microsoft Security Response Center's report. It's a quarterly report. This one's from a few quarters ago that looks at the source of actual exploits running on computers. So not vulnerabilities, not hypothetical things, but actual exploits where people have been able to compromise the system as a result of a vulnerability that was identified. The blue line at the top is Java. There's a lot of risk in running on an older platform. That platform has become irrelevant. So a serviced VB6 is very different from an unserviced VB6 or an unserviced web browser or an unserviced Java runtime. So we need to be mindful of the lifespan and the security implications and the manageability of the platforms that we are using to drive our application strategy. Now, getting out of the applications and more into the project approach, probably the best guidance I can give around the approach that has been most successful is to ensure that you're using a probabilistic approach, one that doesn't focus on being a perfectionist. And I think it's real important to run the math on all of the things that you're trying to do. I found my most effective tool in a lot of conversations has been a calculator. Very simple to go through and run the logic of some of the things that are being proposed. For example, I've heard a lot of requests from customers who are looking to get their inventory of every office document that they use or their inventory of every web application that anyone happens to browse to. And when you start running the math and what the ramifications of that are, you quickly find that with very large sizes of documents or sites or applications, that the tasks that you're proposing simply become out of reach. It's not reasonable to expect to go through and perform that task. So as one such example, if I were to look at, you know, building out and inventory of all of my Office documents, a very typical number of Office documents that we see in use by enterprise customers is somewhere on the order of 25 million documents. And when I think about numbers that big, and as soon as I start having to multiply them, it gets pretty unmanageable really quickly. So with 25 million documents, if I were to get resources that were, say, making $25 an hour and have them spend 5 minutes each looking at every single document, I end up spending $50 million just to go through and do a simple rationalization task. $50 million. I haven't even assessed the compatibility. That's just determining whether I should assess compatibility. And the numbers get even bigger as we add on additional tasks. With numbers that large, it simply doesn't make sense to do it. Now, a reaction to that that I think is very natural is to say, great, well, we'll solve that using tools because tools are much cheaper than people. And that actually can be really successful. The one caution I would give is to ensure that you understand the accuracy of the tools that you're being provided. And for that, we need to make sure that we're applying, you know, all of the statistical rigor. And in this case, I look at the Bayesian algorithm and how that helps us compute whether or not the task that we're chasing is something that's reasonable. So when we think about automation, where automation really was incredibly successful was in the transition from Windows XP to a modern version of Windows, originally from Windows 7. Today, most of the customers I'm talking to are at least considering Windows 8. The accuracy today tends to be about 85%. And it has historically been even higher than that. The reason why the numbers have been going down in terms of accuracy are not because the tools have gotten worse, or because they've forgotten how to write software, but because the problem space has gotten harder. As more time passes since the release of what really was the biggest change in terms of compatibility, which was going from the assumption that every user of Windows was a local admin to the assumption that you're not a local admin, and even if you are, you're not using all of your powers all the time. That happened in about 2006 with Windows Vista. Most of the software that companies and organizations would have purchased from 2007 onward is going to be compatible with that set of assumptions and is likely to be highly compatible with Windows 7 and Windows 8. So by virtue of buying more software, there are fewer things broken. And with fewer things broken, it's harder to find a needle in a haystack than it is to find a needle in a pile of needles. So 85% accuracy, that sounds really terrific, and it actually is quite good. Tools are exceptional today compared to with what we had in the past. But we also need to understand what that means at the individual application level. Applying the Bayesian algorithm, we can see that if we have an estimate that we would find roughly 20% of our applications to be broken, which is what we see on average today, and we have a tool that's providing 85% accuracy, my prediction for a specific app, so overall my average is 85%. I'll be right 85% of the time. That's actually really terrific for estimating. But if I want to look at one specific application and say, is the tool going to be right or wrong? My estimation is going to drop down to about 59% because I have to take into account that I'm predicting based upon an estimated distribution of failures. And those actually goes down. So I can't rely on this, you know, no matter how good my estimation is, to remove the need for people to tell me if that app is working or not. And, you know, what I tend to do is to break things down by criticality and ensure that, hey, if I can afford a tolerance where that level of error at that individual application level is good enough, then that's terrific. If I can't afford that, if I have my number one most critical application, I wouldn't want to just run tooling. I would want to ensure that I actually had a person looking for the 41% of failures that I risk missing. And this challenge of the accuracy distilling down into a hard problem continues to, you know, befuddle us as we start moving into platforms where the number of application failures I have is diminishing. So, for example, when I make a transition from IE8 to IE10, what we find is that the tools tend to get around 30% accuracy. Right? They're less accurate than the Windows tools. Again, not because the tool vendors don't know how to write good software, but because the problem space tends to be a very difficult one. In the space of web application compatibility, a lot of the potential issues are non-deterministic. Sometimes they'll cause a failure, and other times they won't. And it's difficult to tell the difference using any kind of predictive analysis. We really need a person to interpret that. So it just ends up being a harder problem space, and that harder problem space combined with the fact that we have a very small expected incidence of failure means that at the individual application level, we start dropping down into a 2% believability, which means we're going to potentially have a lot of false positives, and we're going to risk having some false negatives as well, right? Because by applying the Bayesian algorithm down to the individual application level, suddenly it's even less accurate than we had there. That doesn't mean we shouldn't use tools to accelerate what we're doing. In fact, quite to the contrary, you know, I have worked with customers and nearly everyone has leveraged tools somewhere. As long as you understand the limitations of those tools, you can understand when what you're looking at is noise and when it's a signal to try and differentiate that, because that turns out to be really important. We look at some of the historical causes of, you know, misinterpreting noise for signal. One of the things that happened historically back in the 1940s is we had some information, some intelligence around Pearl Harbor that suggested that the biggest risk to our Pacific Fleet in the United States was people who were locally living in Hawaii and who may have been, you know, had historical origin from one of the countries with which we were at war. That was the noise. And we missed the signal because we focused too much on that noise, and we had a strategy that brought all of our ships together into one harbor, Pearl Harbor, and they were all sort of gathered nicely. Now, the actual signal was the risk came from airplanes flying over the Pacific on a kamikaze mission and just diving into it. And boy, isn't that convenient that we lined up all of our ships and made it really easy for them to just have a single assault that could find every single ship all neatly lined up. Same is true for EFFs. Obviously, the consequences are far less catastrophic, but the same is true there. If we focus on the noise and we respond to the tools without taking into account their accuracy, we may have the wrong behaviors result from that. And when that's the case, we just need to keep in mind the law of holes. Very simple law. When you realize you're in a hole, it's time to stop digging. We are programmed since childhood to believe that there's always a right answer. And in the world of AppCompat and of software and of technology, there's not always a right answer. You can't always be deterministic. You can believe something works, just as most customers believe that the software they have today is compatible with the operating system that they're currently running. Yet they have software help desks. Those software help desks are addressing what are technically incompatibilities. It's the exact same thing. We're not going to find all of the issues that come beforehand. We can't. The world is simply too complex in order for us to be certain that everything works. And if we put all of our money on certainty, on tools, or on a process that will find everything, we'll find that not only did we not achieve it, but that we misdirected our focus. You know, I've said on many occasions, if you make everything critical, you're not actually making everything critical. What you're doing is you're making nothing critical because you're treating everything the same. So when I think about how do we start treating things differently based upon this probabilistic philosophy, it really comes down to dividing my applications up in a way that allows me to treat them differently. So I normally apply a couple of taxonomies. The first taxonomy is one that categorizes applications based on how I'm going to treat them. Managed applications, supported, unsupported, and banned. My managed applications, those are the ones I want to make sure I look at prior to starting a platform transition. My supported applications, I'm not going to provide that same guarantee to. Those I will support. If you have a problem, you can call up the help desk. We will help you resolve it. That's what we refer to in this diagram as the organic testing, which is the end user will probably find some things that we missed, and that's okay as long as we have a plan to address that. They're still supported. We'll make sure you can get your work done. The unsupported applications won't be treated to any such treatment. If it's unsupported and you call us, you know, we're okay with you running it, but you're on your own if you hit a problem. And then there's band, and that's where we look at an application where it's really critical that it absolutely positively never ever fails. Sorry, never ever runs. So we start trying to block it with things like AppLocker and sort of preventing that from happening, whether for regulatory requirements or for making sure people are focused on all the right things, right? Banned software will actively try to keep off the system. If you call us for help with it, our response will be to remove it. Within the managed applications, which we would subject to structured testing, I like to further differentiate and look at, you know, treating them, to use a bit of an Olympic medal analogy, think of them as platinum, gold, silver, and bronze. My platinum applications, I'm likely to want to have structured testing that does full regression. These are the apps that drive my business. They can't fail. I need to do my due diligence and ensure that all of those things work correctly. My gold applications are important. They are, you know, they are also very central to the business. I don't necessarily need to do a full regression test. I can tolerate some potential risk there. Not a lot, but I do want to go through and do some heavy install launch testing. I want a human to look at it. I want a user to sign off on it, but I don't necessarily need to go through a bunch of scenarios every single time. My silver applications, I might want to do some light install launch testing, apply some tools to it, ensure that things work pretty well, but again, maybe user signs off on it, but not critical that I have the same detailed in depth and time investments because it's less important. And then bronze, yeah, they're important. I'm going to look at them beforehand, but if I take a quick look, they look fine. I may push them and publish them directly. Most people tweak those definitions a little bit as part of it, but that overall idea and notion of ensuring that you're investing your time according to the risk it brings the organization is what brings greater success. We've tried to reflect that in the tools that we provide as Microsoft. So if you've taken a look at the investments we've made in the AppCompat toolkit in version 6, we have actually shifted the focus. The initial focus we had for version 5.5 and earlier, and 5.6, I believe, was the final one that we shipped, was very much focused on down-level evaluation and trying to be predictive. And the challenge we hit up against was that in being predictive, our accuracy wasn't high enough. And without the high-level accuracy, people weren't able to use that information to manage their risk effectively. And so we've transitioned away from that model that had the assumption of accuracy that simply couldn't be delivered against, and moved instead to an up-level model, one that allows us to catch some of the things that are happening when you're in the pilot phase, when you're in the testing phase and the certification phase, or even in pilot or early deployments, that also allows you to have user feedback, to let humans incorporate into the technology and bring all of that together. It's a really very different approach focused on risk and focused on the fact that we tend to combine tools and people both from the technical team side as well as the business side. And as we start to think about the team, it also becomes important to think about how we motivate them and help them to move through, because you know, there's often a lot of resistance. We have a lot of dependencies on people who aren't directly involved in there. And so we really need to focus on how do we get the team to be working together. You know, a lot of that starts with just believing that you can do it. You know, this is an illustration of Pygmalion, and the Pygmalion principle is the one that states that believing you can do it is the first step in actually being able to do it. You know, and that's what we need to inspire from a team perspective, is a universal belief that we're going to be able to get there. When we're doing a transition, particularly if it's a big one, if we're coming off of Windows XP, there's a lot of war stories out there, and people can be very afraid that there's a lot of risk, they're going to go slower, and they feel that that's going to help to manage their risk, and they're going to, you know, go through and apply whatever tools they can. And I'll be honest, the number one use of a tool that I've seen is the ability for someone to check off in a checkbox that they've done it, and then they take the outcome of the reports of that. They stick them away in the back closet and never again look at them between now and the end of time. Instead, we need to start with a belief that you can do it. And to understand what your goals are, to provide that feedback and help to really measure that team performance. The other aspect is to consider the extended team. And we're going to be using, in just about any AppCompat project that we put together, the same approach that Tom Sawyer did when he was trying to help get other people to paint the fence for him. We're trying to convince other people to test our apps for us. Or in essence, test their apps for themselves, I guess you could look at it that way. But we can't take on the full accountability as a technology team. And the reason why is actually a strength to the organization. This is a network diagram that's put together by a researcher from MIT. His name is Cesar Hidalgo, that looks at the extent to which knowledge is disseminated across a network of people, in this case, an entire society. The same is true for an organization. When you think about managing your risk for application failure when transitioning platforms, there really, at this point, is no way for any one person to understand how every single piece of software works and how it's used by a person in every single role. There's simply too much complexity in the organization, and that's not a weakness, that's a strength. We can actually measure the strength of a society and the strength of an organization by the extent to which the organization is distributing knowledge across the network. And you can also then start to measure the effectiveness of that organization by the strength of the connections across that network. And that's what we need to do to be effective, is understand that we have a distributed team, embrace that fact, rejoice it, and figure out ways to traverse it, to get the people who can actually say, this software still solves this business problem for me, and continue to do that across the entire organization until we've truly managed our risk. And then continuing forward, as we have entered into a period of accelerated technology releases, you know, we're seeing new technology come faster and faster and faster. The biggest challenge that we're starting to see is in configuration. Right, people who have gone through and heavily customized their environment to meet all of their specific needs, or in a lot of cases, who have gone through and one by one in every single group policy within some subset of what's available, tried to evaluate what the best possible configuration is. That ends up eventually becoming really unmanageable. If we just take a look at the subset of policies exposed by Internet Explorer, this is the actual number of different permutations of group policies available. By way of comparison, this is the number of molecules in the observable universe. So you can see there's quite a lot of ways that you can configure it. And it turns out we don't have this many tests for Internet Explorer. Most of the configurations that you can set up have never been seen by anyone else in the entire world, basically between the beginning of time and the end of time. You are on your own. And those unique policies have all kinds of unintended consequences. Unintended consequences have dogged us really since the beginnings of society, right? So the illustration here is of wheat. And the domestication of wheat is really what allowed us to form society whatsoever. By having domesticated food sources that we could cultivate and control, that allowed us to settle down and no longer be nomadic. Settling down allowed us to form societies, right? And all living in societies today with the technology built on top of that, we think of that as a good thing. But there were all kinds of unintended consequences of that good thing. The quality of nutrition, it turns out a nomadic hunter-gatherer diet is pretty good for you, right? Nutrition went down. We started to eat a lot of flour. Flour's not so good for you, right? When we look at the state of women in society, in a hunter-gatherer society, it's fairly equal. Probably could be improved somewhat, but certainly after the domestication of grain, the requirements of what happened to women after that was drastically negative compared to where we came from. an unintended consequence. Equality among people grew down. We started to see striation within society. A lot of these things we didn't plan for. The same is true for group policies. I've seen group policies or people set them, and they seem like a good idea. For example, one group policy that we expose in Windows for configuring user account controls to say require a trusted path for providing credentials. And what that translates to is I've got to hit Control-Alt-Delete before I'm allowed to type my password. Well, it turns out that that disables a menu option that is available to run as a different user. Right? From a right-click menu, I can say run this as somebody else. That's a feature of Windows 7, a feature of Windows 8. That goes away if you set that policy because that option doesn't have a trusted code path. If you mandate that you use a trusted code path, we can no longer offer that. An unintended consequence. And those unintended consequences tend to add up over time. What we have found from an escalation standpoint is that from our top escalation team on AppCompat issues, in this case specifically for IE, we see about 10% of the escalations that come in are application issues that are unique to that particular customer's configuration of IE. We cannot reproduce the issue using the default group policies. And as technology moves faster, and as we start looking at more people using, you know, bring your own device strategies, those highly customized configurations begin to have the unintended consequence of limiting your flexibility. So with all of that, we bring together the core concepts of what really drives success in an AppCompat project. It all begins with the app and understanding what it means to be compatible and understanding the value over time of gradually modernizing your applications, not on the pace of the platform, but on the pace of your business to help you become more agile. We talked about how to take a probabilistic approach that says, you know what, nothing's going to be perfect, and if I just plan on not being perfect, I'm probably going to be a lot more successful. And we also talked about the distributed team, how to work with that distributed team, and how to manage configurations and simplify the problem overall. And it's my firm belief, and I've seen it in customer after customer, that if you take these approaches to heart and these fundamental principles to heart and apply them to your approach, I think what you're going to find is that you're a lot more successful in your AppCompat projects. They're going to start getting shorter, which helps you to become more agile. They're going to start getting cheaper, which encourages you to do it a lot more often if you really want to embrace some new technology that comes out. And it really helps you to be more successful at actually managing the risk, which is the goal of these projects in the first place. So with that, I'd like to thank you for joining us today, and we hope to see you at our next Microsoft Virtual Academy presentation.